Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting extravaganza of an episode of The Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the irradiated. It's just so beautiful, and that is the reason why we get really large quantities of tourist dollars. In fact, even New Zealanders aren't under the impression that our country, more or less, has its largest industry being tourism. You didn't know that, did you, New Zealanders? You thought we produced milk products and food and so on and so forth and stuff that actually matters, that allows us to be independent. Sorry to burst that bubble, but we're completely dependent on everybody else coming to New Zealand. So hopefully the Vinnie Eastwood Show will drag people here in droves so that they can enjoy the high rad levels. My very special guest is Kevin P. Lawton. The crowdfundingrevolution.com is his website, and he's a bit of an author. Now, this is a subject very, very near and dear to me hearts, as every single one of you regular subscribers and donors would know. This show is funded by you. And now we're going to interview an author of a book on the subject. I'm quite excited. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinnie, man, it's great to be here with you. I've listened to a lot of your stuff, and I totally enjoyed it, man.
I believe you had some form of quip or Buckminster Fuller quote to start off the episode here.
I'd love to, man. I just like to tell everybody that Buckminster Fuller, I think, probably had the best activist mind on earth, and he really gave us some good tidbits, some real pearls of wisdom. And so here's one of my favorites from him. If you want to teach people a new way of thinking, don't bother trying to teach them. Instead, give them a tool, the use of which will lead to new ways of thinking. R.I.P. my good friend. He had a lot of other great quotes and a lot of fantastic engineering as well that he left us with. But I think that we'd be wise to, you know, kind of rediscover the man.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I hadn't. Yeah, I think he died in something like, you know, 1983 or so.
Oh, well, that was a year before I was even born, son.
Well, we won't talk about me, but.
Okay, let's keep that on the down low.
Yeah.
Kevin, please tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
All right. Well, I mean, like most people, I was born into an insane asylum and then put through an educational concentration camp known as school when I was younger. And like a lot of creative minds kind of, you know, realized early on that wasn't something that made a lot of sense to me, you know, being taught by people, these imposters proposing to be teachers and whatnot. So I guess I was kind of a independent thinker and an autodidactic type of person most of my life. And then I went on to go get what they call an honest job, I guess. My first job was MIT Lincoln Laboratory, worked on a bunch of, I guess you could say, DOD kind of projects. And then, you know, that was a nice place to work, but I had an entrepreneurial mind and went off to start off my first startup company. That was kind of a techie thing, but essentially I modeled the whole PC and software, and that software was done in a sort of an open source model. It was available on the internet, and that was used to essentially research and develop a lot of the virtualization projects out there, VMware and Xen and all these guys. That's one of the key technologies these days in Amazon Cloud, it turns out. So while they got the credit, it's always the case there was somebody before them. And in this case, that would probably be me. And so I went off to do a startup doing that. And fortunately, I had sold the company I was working in that did that and made it completely open source, and then went on to work for a whole slew of other startup companies, some of them venture-backed. Actually, in aggregate, probably some of the companies I worked on have taken over probably about $250 million total in venture finance. Been at early startups in residence at a couple of venture firms and studied venture capital and then, you know, and some economics and finance and capital markets and all kinds of stuff. And along that process, especially being an independent thinker, it really, you know, the whole system really abraded me and occurred to me that, boy, this system is broken, man. This doesn't make any sense at all. This isn't, you know, funded by people who should be funding it. The wrong companies are getting funded. The way people have to approach people to get funding is wrong. The whole bit was broken. So I started blogging, and that blogging sort of converged on a series of presentations that I put on SlideShare.net called The New Face of Venture Capital, Parts 1 through 3. And sort of the end result of that, the conclusion is, you know, the last slide was a lot about crowdfunding and all the detriments of the current system essentially were solved or resolved by, you know, at least an advanced form of crowdfunding, a little bit farther than we are now. But that really got me thinking. And so I started exploring, well, you know, why don't we have crowdfunding platforms instead of going to angels and then later venture capitalists? So I started diving into some, you know, the nasties of SEC regulations and, you know, talking to as many people as I could. And it became clear that the answer is because it's absolutely suppressed. The entire system is just baked to keep people who are entrenched in the system entrenched and people who aren't out. You know, and that dates, in the U.S.-centric view anyway, that dates back to 1933, the Securities Act and 34 Exchange Act, where they essentially created I call it financial apartheid system in the United States, and many of the other countries adopted similar things in the similar time frame. Essentially, it's sort of a template. So you can see that template happen in other countries.
More or less, it's a legal framework that doesn't sound totally tyrannical to people looking at it, but it actually is and works quite well in its fashion and its design.
Absolutely, man. I mean, they literally, when I say apartheid, I'm not really kidding, because they literally classify people into two buckets. There's an accredited and non-accredited. And that sounds like you took a degree or some kind of training or what have you. But the truth is, accredited just means someone with enough wealth. That's it. And then there's people without it, and they're non-accredited, or the, you know, proletariat class, essentially. And you know, and then they went even further, essentially, along the way, and they made sure that financial advisors could only recommend listed stocks, which to us really means public stocks. So there you go, right? You can't even have a financial advisor who's very savvy and early phase investing, essentially going out to the general public and saying, hey, look, here's a local startup company. You know, it's a organic bakery or something, or a nice little mini farmstead. You know, they can't even... if they wanted to, they could not recommend it to you. So they really boxed out people from talking to other people. I mean, it's really nothing more than, in the U.S., a First Amendment obliteration, essentially. They just disabled people's ability to reach out to their own kind and you know, look for financing from people who would actually maybe even live next door, for example, you know, God forbid. So it really is an apartheid system, and it's worked really well for the intended consequence, which seems to be shutting out people. So I started, you know, blogging a lot and talking to people and researching, and then hooked up with a guy who was doing, you know, he's working on his PhD, and he was really concentrating on crowdfunding. And he saw some of my work online and said, hey, you know, I'm writing this book. Man, some of your thinking is fantastic. Let's write this book together. So I ended up being an accidental author and, you know, researching and talking and got to know as many people as I could. And oddly enough, the people at the Office of Science and Technology at the White House heard about crowdfunding and, hey, this might be something for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And ended up doing a conference call with them about, you know, the whole kind of context of crowdfunding and who would be the next few people to talk with. And then kind of hooked up in the sidelines with some people who were advocating for, you know, getting congressional hearings. And, you know, just I was really always on the sideline, but a lot of the kind of intellectual thinkings that I put on the table in the book, the blog, and otherwise ended up in some of the written testimony. And to make a long story short, they had a really good impact in the House with McHenry's bill, which was just fantastic. This really light touch just really opened the doors without a lot of red tape. And then it got passed to the Senate and dirtied up as much as you could imagine, and then got passed as part of a six-pack of things in the Job Act. Legalization of crowdfunding, not Kickstarter style for perks and whatnot, but for security, so equity, debt, revenue share, and these kinds of things. And then, you know, they did the classic thing after getting a lot of votes from passing that, which is they passed it off the SEC to, you know, further generate some more red tape pile that no one can work through. And then promised to do it within a year, and now it's a couple of years, and we're still waiting. Still waiting for the finalization for a law that we have where people still, at least the common people, can't use crowdfunding in a meaningful way. However, one of the other pieces was an extension of crowdfunding for accredited investors like angels and whatnot, and they finalized on that, and that's working now. So I guess they have to work harder to protect the people, in air quotes, of course. And so that's where we're at.
Are you telling me that you've actually helped to put legislation that is now in effect in the United States?
I've been involved in it. I don't think I want to get too much further than that much involvement. At one point, they were actually asked, the friends who did, you know, they went in front of Congress. They were wondering if I wanted to go for the next round. And I said, you know, the problem is that I have this problem that I tell the truth, and I'm not sure that's the guy you want testifying.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, you probably would have been kicked out of the House or held in contempt or something. This man's telling the truth. Put him in jail.
Yeah, we're all being suppressed. Leave the building.
Yeah. You know, that's un-American. Fight for freedom. What is he doing about? We have no history of that.
Yeah. However, the great news out of this whole thing is it did sort of spread. The idea spreads, you know, lighting fires in the minds of men, I suppose. But, you know, other countries did their own. My co-author had his fingerprints in the Italian version of it, and that's kind of went through a little bit quicker. And maybe it's not the perfect bill either, but at least that, you know, that kind of lit a fire there, and it got other people thinking in different countries about, geez, you know, maybe we should let regular people be involved in creating companies, as radical as that is. And so the idea is out there, and it's available. And frankly, any country that enables it and really, really puts, you know, emphasis on allowing to happen rather than adding red tape, I think is going to have a phenomenal economic impact from it.
Can you explain and define exactly what crowdfunding is and also what the term open source means?
Sure. Let's start with open source. So I'm old enough, it turns out, to have been, you know, involved in open source fairly early. So, for example,
hey, so is the Heinz Corporation. They know how to open source.
Yeah, we'll just skate right past that comment. But so, you know, in the 80s, I got involved in this idea of open source, which is just really collaborative software creation. And what happened is I went to school. I went to college at just the right time when the internet was really coming online, and you know, we could have these things, these radical things called email, and you know, massive online player games and stuff like that going on. But at any rate, what had happened was the internet really opened up the ability for people between schools, and then even people outside of schools, to start collaborating on creating software, just because they could, to be honest with you, you know. And it's sort of like any other collaborative environment where birds of a feather flock together, and people started creating games and tools, utilities, and all kinds of stuff together, and that sort of blossomed into this what you see now actually running on most of the servers in the world, or I should say, yeah, I would say majority of them are running Linux these days, which is a whole complex of software created in a collaborative environment, so literally on in every country, probably in every school. You know, every zip code almost is probably someone helping with open source on the earth. And so I got involved in that early, and I author of a couple projects there. And so that's kind of open source. And that's interesting because before we get to, you know, really in the crowdfunding, think open source set the stage for sort of a way of thinking and a way of existing that's a predecessor to a lot of the kind of new emerging models that we've got crowdfunding.
Can I interject?
Yeah,
because it seems that via your definition and explanation of what open source is, this is actually the model by which most in the conspiracy movement work together.
Yeah, absolutely. You're open sourcing truth, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're collaborating over something, and I guess you could even say so that what there's the collaborative part, and then there's the openness that, you know, a lot of them people in the truth movement are working in the open. I guess closed source, which would be the commercial software, the analog to your statement would be the, you know, the internet stooges that go out there and slam people. You know, anyone that has any kind of resonance of truth gets some kind of a troll comment, you know, about how their comments crap, or, you know, they don't like the way they look, or they have bad hair or something like that.
Oh, bro, the internet has bigger troll armies than the frickin' Lord of the Rings, bro.
No kidding, man. See, I think that's the mistake from the people with positive intent, because, see, I think we later we'll get into why I think that activism has been kind of lame and how you need to amp it up. But
oh, it's been compromised, to be sure, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's no reason why regular people can't be inverse trolls, right? So why not go out there and pretend to be a troll and then point people to a URL that's supposedly dispelling somebody's truth and then turns out to be even more information?
Mm. Hey, what's trolls backwards? Slot. Ladies?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. If you're going out there and you're being slotty online, you have something to be proud about.
You're adding value, man. So, like, I think a lot of these things, things that we, you know, we sort of despise them, but on the other hand, a lot of the problem is really that people just haven't thought about turning it on its head, right? So, you know, in some ways, open source guys, they had kind of a chip off their shoulder against some of the controlled software and commercial ware, and you know, they went out and they just made their own software. So they just kind of did it.
I just had a conversation last night with a guy who is very similar to me, and I think you are too, in that we've got this. We're not employee men. Okay, you know, we're not very good at being employees, namely because we don't like working for people that are dumber than us. And we require independence and the ability to create and make things that don't currently exist. Employment opportunities in that regard, with an employer who respects you, who's smarter than you, and can allow you all of those freedoms, they're extremely rare. And most people like us, either A1, they decide to keep working in a slave job for their entire life, and then when they die, they have a list of regrets. Or two, they destroy their life in order to become independent and then build themselves back up from scratch again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the manager that you mentioned that's, you know, really smart and can deal with people and you really respect, it's kind of like finding a two-headed unicorn in some ways. And but the interesting thing I've noticed is there's, you know, I've in technology, you can't help but work with a lot of supposedly intelligent people. And what happens is a lot of them, you know, they know that they're work slaves. It doesn't take a genius to realize when you're in a cube, you've just, you know, changed from one kind of prison bars to the other. But they realize it, but there's a little bit of this sort of denial complex that people get where, you know, it seems like everybody else is doing this, so it can't be that bad, right? And so they kind of stay in that grind. And then you realize a little bit when you're older, hey, wait a minute, I've been working, you know, 70 hours a week for how many years and barely taking vacations. And, you know, and geez, my financial manager tells me I'm going to have to work for another 70 years before I can retire. Guess what? There is no retirement, man. You know, so it's
what they call the ladder climbing. And people are foolish. They believe people who are more powerful than them, believing that authority can be trusted. And this is a bad idea. What did I say? Business is like politics. Foolish people think that they can change that system, that company, that country, etc., from within. This is the big lie.
Right.
This is how they attract good apples and force them into the bad barrel.
There was this fantastic quote from my favorite comedian, the late Bill Hicks. I hope people know who Bill Hicks is.
He's my favorite too. In fact, he was probably my broad base awakening to becoming a truther in the first place when I was at university all those years ago.
Wow, man, what a coincidence that is, huh? He, you know, he said something. It was this big long spiel, but at the end, he said, "You know, people, the reason why the systems around us are failing us is because they're no longer relevant. You know, evolution did not stop when we acquired opposable thumbs. You know that, right?" And I mean, the impact of that statement is, it's, there's so much analysis of that in one comic routine, right? Where, and it's just what you said, people are fighting, like another Buckminster quote about, you don't change things fighting the existing reality. You change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And that's exactly what a lot of these alternative socioeconomic paradigms that I've been looking into are doing. And it's what we did in open source. It's to some extent what crowdfunding is about. And going forward, I think the real new, you know, I wrote the series New Face of Venture Capital. The new face of activism, I think, is exactly obeying the thinking, at least letting it resonate with you, what you said, that, you know, let's not get inside and try to change stuff. It's like trying to change somebody, you know, like trying to change a person. You know, my mom told me when I was younger, you'll never teach anyone anything. They can only learn it. And, you know, trying to change somebody is sort of like that. It's like pushing up against a brick wall. And so I'm really happy when people just finally get so disgusted trying to change stuff that they think, hey, well, let's just create something else, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot to talk about that in this conversation about, you know, upcoming models and what, you know, what we can do in activism and so forth.
Mm. It's like freaking Sinatra. I did it my way.
You have to, there's a certain personality trait that helps you kind of be that way too, right? Where, like, I think I was born iconoclastic, you know, I think there's a button and I have to go push it. And, you know, if somebody's all kind of, arrogant about, you know, look at me, I'm a manager, I'm running something, it's almost like you want to go up and kind of poke him in the eye just for being a douche. And so
I think the curse is being intelligent enough to realize how stupid everyone else is.
There's some truth in that, man. But, you know, it's interesting. Part of my sense of activism anyway is I've found as many ways as possible that did not work activating people. Just by accident, like trying this, trying that, and realizing none of this crap's working, right? And I created this phrase, I call it thought bomb. You know, it's like if someone's in a foxhole, right, and you're shooting bullets over their head, they'll just duck and they'll entrench in their foxhole even deeper. they're not coming out, man. Those bullets whizzing over, you can talk about chemtrails or banksters or whatever, right? GMO food. It's just like more bullets over them. But you throw a thought grenade in their foxhole, they're coming out. And sometimes, you know, it's not just about intellect, but that the way that someone's being approached doesn't flush them out. You have to really, really give someone a reason to jump out of their foxhole. And so I think some of the people who are kind of outside the system have to think with higher leverage in terms of activating people.
And we considering activation, I don't think that it's possible to do it kind of like this gently approach that people are talking about, you know, like, oh, right, you've got to present the information in a way that's acceptable and palatable and blah, 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 blah. Dude, I'm not the mainstream media, okay? I am going to destroy your brain by giving you a bullet of information to the head, and it will take you a long time to heal from that injury. Same as everybody else, it's not pleasant.
Sorry, man, but I just JFK'd the old you.
Yeah,
absolutely, man. That's how it's got to be done. And it seems almost cruel at some levels, but it's even crueler letting somebody, in my opinion, live in an old paradigm that's going to end in their demise anyway. And so I've started to explore and find ways that are a lot better at activating. Like, for example, I was at a local town meeting here around the Mountain View area. I'm in Silicon Valley, or Silicon Valley, as I like to call it, for those who don't know the area. And, there were some people talking about how, the zoning commission's going to, like, ban living in these zones, and they're going to make public transit down this big corridor. You know, this El Camino Real is going to be converted to, like, I don't know, the Grand something or other. And it just rings of Agenda 21 kind of stuff. And so I'm listening to them, and they're like, yeah, let's get together and have a neighborhood meeting. And I go there, and they're all talking about it, and no one has a clue what's going on. And I said, I just want to check. Do you guys know about Agenda 21? Because that's what's going on here. And they're like, Agenda 21, what's that? You know? And I said, well, here's the deal. You know, you should learn about it, and it'll explain what's going on. Of course, none of that worked, right? People aren't going to go learning about anything. It's like, well, hey, I don't know that. It must not be that. If I didn't hear it in, Fox News or CNN, it can't be that important.
I love that. If I haven't heard about it before, it doesn't exist. Like,
yeah,
bro, yeah. When was the last time you learned something new in your life? Well, I'm sorry. We're coming to break right now. Kevin, we'll be right back, folks. This episode is sponsored by Blue Shield, but also, more specifically, Kevin's novel, which you can purchase off the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, The Crowdfunding Revolution. Check it out, and we'll be right back.
It's Peace Train, holy roller. Everyone jump up on the Peace Train.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is still author Kevin Lawton, the author of The Crowdfunding Revolution at thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. You can see a link to his book on the homepage, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Bear in mind, we do take now a little bit of advertising revenue, so if you have a small business or a book or something like that you want to promote, just approach me, throw some money at me, just like everybody else. So yeah, this show is still, by the way, vastly, mostly funded just by listener subscriptions and donations. So don't think because we've got a few little banners and ads on the website that it's capable of paying for rent, power, fuel, and everything else that you need to do to pay for to expose scumbaggery and attend protests and interview people and all of that kind of stuff. It's just not enough. And we would love to have resources, you know, so you can help people. There's two types of people that try to accumulate resources. One that try to accumulate it all for themselves so that they can help only themselves. And the others who try to accumulate resources for themselves so that they can help other people. Okay? I'm the latter. Believe me. And if you don't believe me, I can show you lots of evidence. Interviews for years and years and years. It'll literally take you at least 2 years solid of viewing exclusively my content before you could get through half of it. I'm not kidding. There's that much. I've done a lot of work and helped a lot of people get their word out. So if you want to help me continue to do that, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and click donate or subscribe for a couple of dollars a month, whether through PayPal or preferably the Kiwi Bank, because PayPal takes a percentage. Kevin, welcome back.
All right, man. It's good to be back.
Now, where were we when we just broke off that last segment there?
I was talking about the situation that some people from local community were trying to, you know, trying to kind of push back against some development plans that sound a lot like Agenda 21 and activism, and how, you know, people tend to like to think that, hey, if I haven't heard about it before, it can't be that important. And I realized after the fact, instead of informing people with just a, you know, kind of general bullet points on a you know, PowerPoint presentation type of thing, even though it was really just verbal, I realized, you know, there are a lot better ways to kind of shake people loose of their thinking. And so then I realized, you know, next time I have a meeting, I think I'm going to hire a couple guys dress up in bankster suits and with sunglasses, the whole lot, and just show up and quietly mill around. People will be like really suspicious. Who are these people?
I like that. I have a bankster suit and sunglasses.
Yeah, man, that'd be great. You know, if you're out this way, let's get you activating, man. Because I was thinking we could tell them, hey, look, if someone asks you, what are you guys doing here? You know, you say, you know, let's just say that we represent the banking industry and we want to see how easy it is going to be to take your land. and then quietly, after stirring around and then just saying a few things, just quietly leave. And then what will happen is people will be, you know, the thing is, honestly, when groups of people get together, you know, we could call it activism. I think a lot of it's voyeurism. I think people just like to be around other people talking about something happening, yeah. You know, and, you know, it's, and honestly, activism is really reactivism. People are just reacting to stuff anyway. And so
there's the two elements here. There's activism and entrepreneurism. One kind of holds back the progress of those who want to hold back the entrepreneurs, and one creates new stuff for the activists to oppose.
There's a lot of dynamics going on, and that might even segue in a little bit into you know, my thoughts about crowdfunding and venture capital and a lot of the, I like to go and dispel a lot of belief systems. One of them is venture capital and why that's supposedly so fantastic. And I mean, we could talk about a lot of stuff, but that's a great segue into that, actually.
Well, by all means, regale me.
So in a lot of ways, when I talked about the Securities Act in 3334, kind of boxing people out, creating this apartheid system, really what that did when regular people couldn't fund each other for their small businesses and whatnot was, would it put the control into the hands of a few people who could acquire pools of money. Venture guys generally, they just actually get their money from somebody else. They're an indirect investor, so they get money from insurance trusts and CalPERS, you know, these kind of retirement funds, whatnot. And so because they're, you know, considered accredited investors or people with their own net worth or accredited investors, then it really consolidated down into fewer and fewer hands. And then the venture capital industry really blossomed because there was nothing else. I mean, banks don't lend money to high volatility, seed stage funded startup companies. It's just not what they do. You know, revenue, no product, no clue. So essentially, the venture capital industry is a byproduct in a lot of way a lot of ways off of the suppression that happened in the early 30s in the U.S. and a little bit later in other countries. And you have, you know, you have these people, these MBAs and spreadsheet jockeys and all that wearing suits. I call them circus monkeys, but we'll call them venture capitalists. And they, you know, run around being self-important and drive their hot cars and stuff like that. The end of the day, these guys are the least venturesome people on earth. They are nothing but cherry pickers. Angel investors are a little bit better, but venture capitalists, the way they really work these days, they used to do a little bit more aggressive investing, but they pretty much run around waiting until a deal is obvious. They got a whole bunch of users or some lineup of products, revenue, what have you, a lot of traction, as they like to say. And they find ones that are so obvious that they just all pile in and try to be the one to invest in that particular deal. And I mean, just to kind of, you know, to sort of summarize things here, obviously we're putting everybody in a bucket, but, and at the end of the day, only a few percent of the venture capital firms really make outsized returns. A lot of them make very little, nothing, or a lot of them lose money. They're really an awful investment for most of the limited partners. And when you talk to these guys, you realize really quickly that there's nothing about venture and venture capital. It's all about cherry picking. So that my favorite cherry picking analogy is like, if there's a tree, a lot of cherries, luscious cherries dangling off, people come and they pick the bottom layers, and then maybe they stretch out a little bit to pick the upper layers. But the ones at the top, the people with the tall step ladders get to them. And that's really just the brand affinity that a lot of these, you know, famous venture capitalists have. They have a network and they're the go-to VCs because, hey, you know, everyone else knows that Sequoia is a great venture capital firm, blah, blah, blah. That's the stepladder, man. Other than that, venture capital is really, really not a good model. And I'll go into that a lot, actually, as much as you guys like to hear, because it's really important for people to understand that while people are worshiping these guys, there's an entire cult of entrepreneurs who just worship the brand name venture capitalist. It's really not a good model. And one of my favorite points to make, and this really will be a great segue later in the crowdfunding, is this. If you want to find those big outlier ideas that turn into the next Google, Facebook, or whatever, Tesla electric car, what have you, you need access to a huge amount of data points, meaning a lot of potential deals. So you need an enormous volume of potential deals and then an ability to sift through those deals. And I just boil it down to call it synthesis. You need synthesis. That's what a large crowd does. And if we look to how the crowd has done synthesis at finding outliers or predicting outcomes across the board, like predicting what the box office receipts or the presidential election or, you know, some weather event or whatever, internally at companies they call decision markets. They use what are called a prediction market externally, but internally a decision market to use the entire knowledge base of all the employees in a company to actually predict an outcome or make a decision. And it turns out time after time that these mechanisms surpass the ability of any expert panel or any hierarchy of management to make decisions or predict outcomes. Every time, by big margins, like they're 90-something% accurate. They even predict at Innocentive did a great study. There's a company that does a sort of crowdsourced decision market. They have a thing where they realized in pharmaceutical companies, when they're going through the various stages of trials, that the employees could actually predict which drugs would go from one stage to the next, whereas the management had the worst time predicting. And so that same mechanism is exactly what crowdfunding is. It's a giant synthesis market with huge amounts of input and a lot of sorting capacity. And by the way, nothing democratic about the synthesis. And that's the important part. You need to really identify outliers. You need outlier identifiers. So you need to weight people's decisions based on their, for example, their past ability to predict something, predict an event, or to be able to solve a problem. you have it's an true. Enormous...
You need outliers, but also you need to kick out actual liars from your
family. Yeah, and you can find those with outliers. That's the beauty, is you can find charlatans. And it was interesting. I go to these crowdfunding conferences, and people are talking about regulation. You know, we got to protect the people, right? One of the biggest mind screws ever.
I love that. You know, in fact, that reminds me, I just saw a Morgan Freeman post that is brilliant. Let me see if I've got this correct. You believe people can't govern themselves, but you believe some people can govern hundreds of millions of other people?
That's kind of like in, I think it was 1984, the Orwell book, where there was that saying on the barn, you know, all animals are created equal, but some animals are created more equal.
Animal Farm.
Animal Farm.
Written by George Orwell, who also wrote 1984.
Yeah, that's sort of in the same vein, man. And actually, that's basically, you could say that about venture capitalists. You know, they're the... you know, the slightly smarter or better animals or more equal animals.
I love it how they have the same letter starting it as vulture capitalists. That you can't make the stuff up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of people call them that. I like to call them circus monkeys, but I hate to, you know, say bad things about vultures. But actually,
do you know why vultures never have much luggage when they go on commercial flights?
Why is that, man?
Because they prefer carrion.
Jesus. You just come up with this stuff real time, huh?
Yeah.
So,
it's an incredibly worthless skill. Like, you know how some people are really good at something that is absolutely useless?
Like remembering the trivia tidbits and whatnot?
Yeah.
Hey.
Spend your entire life doing this. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up now. Continue.
No, it's probably why you're still sane, though, at the end of the day. So I'm sure there's a lot of use to it.
Well, you got to laugh at the insanity. Otherwise, you join it.
Absolutely, man. I was at a, they have these panels, so they have these networking events around here, and they had a panel of venture capitalists and maybe an angel investor on stage, you know, talking whatever smack about the industry, and they got to the Q&A, and I'm like your worst nightmare if you give me the microphone. I'm always the guy at every conference asking the, you know, the one-inch punch questions that no one want to get hit with, and so I get up. And I ask, said, you know, you guys are in the business of financing innovation. Can you tell me the last innovation in venture capitalism? And there was this large, uncomfortable pause in the room. Like no one said anything. And then one guy, I think he was an angel actually, sheepishly admitted, well, we're really not that innovative of a kind of people. So, I'm not sure how I got into that, but anyway, that was a nice little story to give you an idea that we've got people, vulture capitalists, you know, funding people without having a clue about how to innovate in their own field, you know.
Mm. Well, I think this is actually brings upon an important point. My former producer once told me that people bring three elements to the deal: talent, resources, or capital. Would you agree with that?
Well, those are three components you can bring to a deal for sure. Hopefully people bring, you know, some other components, right? Some people bring their sort of, I guess you could call it a resource, but they're sort of their network. And some people are good at, ideating and shaping ideas, and some good at marketing and graphics design and all these kind of things. But it's a general rule. That's sort of a good place to start, what you mentioned. And at some point too, we could get into, I have some pretty interesting thoughts on Bitcoin and money and some other things like credibility networks that very few people are really talking about out there. So whenever you'd like, we can kind of vector into some of those topics.
By all means, proceed.
Yeah. So Bitcoin and the whole alt currency space, obviously that's really exploded over the last year. And, you know, I fear that people have got kind of roped into a really poor design, a really kind of there's an element of Bitcoin and friends that is really good in the sense that it inspires people to think there's something else. And so for that, I give it an enormous amount of credit. It's just that I hate when people vector their energy into something new and it's kind of just as crappy or nearly as crappy as where they came from. And that's the way I feel about Bitcoin. So one of my big issues about this whole Bitcoin situation is, or all these altcoins really, is if you think about money in general, one of the big problems in my opinion is money is we have this thing I call dynasty. And that is the people that were in the system before who were able to lever it and, you know, use it to their advantage, they accumulated more money. They accumulated this dynasty, the ability to use that money to then get more money, you know, whether they're investors or what have you. And you could think about it as money or resources or whatever. And then it comes along a young generation that starts out with nothing. In fact, they start out in debt, you know, Visa cards and student bills and all these kinds of things, really indentured servants. And they have the opposite of dynasty, right? They have no leverage whatsoever, even though they probably have the most capacity to generate something interesting in the future. And so they're starting out negative money. And in a lot of ways, that accumulation of dynasty leads to more accumulation of it, because once people have it, they just can't get enough of it, and at least a lot of people in that position. And so then they use it to their advantage, and they go around and do things like buy up politicians and other kind of, you know, other kinds of peoples, other police judge or what have you. And they do more and more sketchy things to accumulate more dynasty. So then they, in a relative scale, the common people have less and less. And we have unfortunately got caught in a system where we worship fake, you know, electronic digits these days in some bank account of some person who accumulated these digits from somebody else, generally through some form of usury. And it's really an unfortunate model. And then what we did with Bitcoin and friends is we recreated that. It's just a different set of people have the digits. And actually, there's only some gamers and people like this accumulated Bitcoin early. Good for them. I don't have any problem with that. But honestly, there's a lot of rich people now that own a big chunks of Bitcoin. And so you have actually really 100, 200 people who own a good chunk of Bitcoin. That's dynasty already, and it's fairly young as an idea. And then it turns out that the amount, there's only 10 or 20 exchanges of Bitcoin that really handle most of the traffic, and the same for the people that are mining, big companies that are doing the mining. So you have hardware dynasty, exchange dynasty, and currency dynasty all in one within just a small amount of years. And, I'd really like to send the message out to people that if someone really wants to create the currency of the future, then make a currency so it's people-sourced, so that by virtue of being alive, you actually get allocated units of currency. And on top of that, not on a basis of one time. I mean, there was a Spanish coin and a currency in Iceland they tried to do this with, where they did a one-time allocation across everybody who was essentially a citizen. That sounds great, but then what happens for the people who were born right after that? They're locked into this feudalism or this serfdom because some people before them have this dynasty. So if we really want to honor the rights of people, we have to make the money creation continuous and into everybody. Source people as the way of creating money rather than lending it through a bank. And then let people spend and invest it. And I've got a blog post on thecrowdfundingrevolution.com about this kind of new model. I'm interested in talking with anybody who would like to actually do it. I don't have the time myself, but I think this would be a more interesting model that would be a great stepping stone between where we are and where we could go, such that we would actually honor people's existence instead of starting off as a feudal slave. So that's a kind of overview of some of the critiques I have. Obviously, there are other issues like Bitcoin has a fairly lengthy sign-off time. And what that does is the following. If you're doing an exchange online through Bitcoin, generally a lot of vendors, they're really taking the Bitcoin and doing an exchange, maybe using BitPay or other, to go from Bitcoin to cash. And in a long, even if you wait 15, 20 minutes to sign off, what that does is that actually maps into volatility of the price, which has to get absorbed by the people doing the crossing the currency grid. as a fee, essentially. So by way of having a long sign-off time, you end up jacking up the fee, essentially. And then it sort of moots some of the point about how Bitcoin's better than some of the other payment services because of lower fees and whatnot. So, you know, there's some issues there. And then Bitcoin itself has a problem where people are mining it on special purpose processors, essentially. And what that does is it means that you need quite a bit of money to get a current device to be able to mine competitively. And in fact, every month you need to go throw that away or sell it on eBay and get a different one. And it becomes a hardware arms race. And what happens is fewer and fewer people are able to keep up with the arms race. And so at the end, guess what? A few people own most of the mining equipment.
Yeah, and not to mention the banks own both sides of all of those operations anyway, because Absolutely. They couldn't have even started those operations without the vulture capitalists from the international banks who can make money out of thin air to process in the first place.
Absolutely, man. And then you think about it, if you're a bankster and you can print money out of thin air at will, you could just pretty much mop up. You could just, distort, smack down, smack up the price of whatever these alt currencies are. They're tiny. The total market cap of all the alt currencies, I think, is $20 billion or something like that. I mean, you could just mop up whatever you wanted and own a big chunk and then swing the price around. You know, you could just send it into oblivion, making people pay big fees with the volatility and so forth. So it's really not a good model. It's not a well-thought-out model. It's not that I blame somebody, because they probably weren't even thinking about really doing it, using it on a wide scale like it is today. But I'm just making the point that don't get stuck in thinking that Bitcoin is the ultimate future. It's not. It's not even close. And it's that, it has a public ledger. Police have said they love Bitcoin because it leaves such a forensic trail that it makes it easy for them to trace money, whereas cash is hard to trace. So don't get wrapped up in that kind of thinking. There are far better models, and I hope that people investigate some of them.
See, I've always avoided Bitcoin and what have you. I'm just using PayPal at the moment, and they're kind of like perhaps an evil scum corporations or whatever. But I'm a fan of, if you can use an evil person's resources to accomplish good ends, then it's all right.
Hey, yeah, God's truth is still truth, man, everywhere it goes. So absolutely, use whatever you've got.
Yeah, I mean, like if you were to break the law and let's say, I don't know, hack into David Rockefeller's personal checking account and steal $100 million, and then you give that $100 million to, let's say, 100 different conspiracy theorists who have already got really good radio shows and YouTube channels and so on, and they go, here you go, guys, here's a boost, you're all Rockefeller funded now. Would everybody refuse the money?
Yeah, I hate to encourage that publicly, but it's an interesting idea. Yeah, I hear you, man. I mean, I think there's a real problem I have with purism. So many people get wrapped up with trying to stay completely pure and then end up being completely ineffective. Right, I mean, it's.
Oh my God! You just described half the conspiracy movement, bro.
Yeah, unfortunately, but you know what? At the end of the day, I think a lot of, isn't it the case in history, and I hope going forward anyway, that a lot of the real meaningful movements and things that have been done in the world are done by small groups of people, and so there are a lot of people that are just along for the ride or really, kind of wrapped up in their own little thought bubble they got going on. It doesn't really matter that much, I mean, some people do get kind of a little too purist in the activism category. But it's for, here's my great analogy. People, we all love to, myself included, berate the sheeple of the world. But at the end of the day, I think that, it's good, clean fun, right? The sheeple are probably going to be the shining light in the end. And here's the reason I say it. Because, think, if guys like us are sheepdogs and there's a herd of sheep, and on the other side is these wolves, right? They're the banksters and all these kind of bad guys. The sheep, they're they're just cheap, man. They're going to do what sheep will do. And the real strategy here is in the minds of the sheepdogs, right? If the sheepdogs activate the flock in the right direction, man, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what's going on with those wolves. They're going to get run over. And so, like, sometimes I think that the real problem with activizing people is really in the minds of the few people who actually are kind of have enough perspective to see the bigger picture, but are not using high leverage to activate people. They're not doing the right kind of activism. They're making all the mistakes I did over the years of, you know, trying to tell people the truth and information and, you know, all these kind of rude things.
I love those naive mistakes. I'll go out and tell people the truth and they'll believe me because it's true.
Yeah.
Where did I
get that idea?
I thought the universe had justice and logic and reason. Oh, wait, no, actually, it's completely mad. And that old adage that in an insane world, a sane man must appear insane is certainly true. Kevin Lawton, the author of The Crowdfunding Revolution, links to the book on the homepage of thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. There also his website, thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. We'll be right back.
You are the only exception. You are the only exception.
Loving you isn't the right thing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest in this episode is sponsor Kevin Lawton from thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. Now, we were talking over the break about smarmy, hubris-filled people. I wanted to actually have a discussion about this because it's one of those natural elements that you will encounter when you talk about things that are outside of the mainstream. I mean, anybody can talk about American Idol or X Factor and America's Got Talent and any other mainstream distraction that you want, and you will never be criticized or attacked or called an idiot for only consuming that content and never thinking for yourself. In the main. However, if you do the opposite and you choose to talk about things that matter, all those people who spend their entire life obsessed with things that don't matter will insult you, will fire you from your job, will report you as suspicious activity and things like this. And it reminds me of the Matrix training program with the woman with the red dress. You're looking at the woman with the red dress. You're looking at the woman with the red dress. Suddenly she's gone and there's an agent right there with a gun in your face. Training program's there to teach you one thing, ladies and gentlemen. You are either unplugged like one of us or you are potentially an agent of the system. Kevin, welcome back.
All right. It's great to be back again.
How do you like that analogy I just throw out there?
Well, unfortunately, it's kind of valid. You see it everywhere, right? Everyone runs into that in the truth movement, spending all their energy and dissipating into people who pretty much just kind of vampire the energy out of people with good intent. So it's one of the big lessons of the universe people need to learn, right, is to either how to deal with those people or how to just bug out, essentially. Don't let the people vampire your energy. And also, like, it's great practice, too, though, because some of these people, they come with the, come out with these smarmy comments about how you must be, you know, crazy and idiotic. And if you want to practice your ability to create and throw thought grenades into their foxhole, there's some good people to do it with. And if you can figure out how to, you know, how to frag those people to, you know, and just really obliterate them in front of people, then I think you're off to a good start.
What's ironic is that they're not bright enough to realize that they're being obliterated, and they're not honest enough to admit when they're wrong. If anything, you could, the best you can hope for is to outnumber them in a bullying sense of the word. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, this is just what I've discovered. You can't win a conversation with somebody like that, okay? You can only what was it Mark Twain said? He says, never argue with somebody who is an idiot because they will beat you with their experience.
Right, yeah. Something equivalent was never argue with the crazy people because it's hard for people outside to differentiate who is who.
Hey, so, oh my God, that's actually a really good quote as well, because I see people like myself arguing with people who are, say, like, for example, chemtrail deniers, and then you have these third parties who come in and say that they don't want to look at what either me or the chemtrail denier is saying, because the mere fact that we're having an argument over something is a put off that creates mm-hmm. confusion that prevents people wanting to investigate further and figure out what's actually going on, because they don't know who to believe, because they refuse to look at any of the evidence and make their own decision and their own thoughts about it.
Yeah, you know, this actually is, this is really interesting topic to me, because I have this idea I call the one-step activism. And the idea here is that, look, you know, if you just ask somebody, you know, take this step one foot of distance, you know, ah, oh, that's no problem. Well, how about 3 feet? Maybe not too problem. Well, I'll take this Olympic-sized jump, you know, do 27 feet, whatever. That's not going to happen. They're not going to expend the energy to even try. You got. I think one of the critical pieces for activists, they have to realize that people are only going to take that one simple step, and so really the key is to find out where is someone in the scheme of things. You know, what's their level of consciousness? What are they aware about? And then just give them one little thing, and maybe not even in the direction of pure information, but sometimes just really kind of like. Do you watch these movies? Yes Men. Where these guys spoof conferences. You can kind of be a yes man type. Like if someone's, you know, doesn't believe about chemtrails, then you just you say, you know, are your kids involved in that that chemtrail drawing contest? I heard you can win like a scholarship. You know, and they're like, What? Yeah, whoever can draw the most beautiful chemtrails, you know? And like, what are chemtrails? Oh, it's just these, you know, just these things left behind by planes, you know. And then you go, and then, you know, you start talking to him about it, and you realize, well, let me send you some photos of chemtrails. And of course, you send him some links from some chemtrail conspiracy site or something. So the thing is to get him involved without saying no or reacting first, and then let them actually go find it. It's kind of it sort of goes back to the way I opened with the Buckminster Fuller about, you know, forget trying to teach somebody, just give them a tool, and then it'll lead to a new way of thinking.
May I offer something supplementary to this? What was her name? Dr. Rima Labor from the DrRimaTruthReports.com. I told her once that, you know, you need to tell people a certain amount of time, and she actually corrected me and gave me the actual number. It takes 7 people to tell you this exact same thing, 7 different people, mind you, before you will abandon a really strongly held belief, right? So it occurred to me, I have to play my part. If I see a mother with her child's head next to an iPad with wireless signals shooting through its brain, and I go up and say to her, excuse me, you do realize that's dangerous for your baby, and she goes, bugger off, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, I'll just go, okay, no problem. I hope 6 other people tell you the same thing I did and that you wake up. But there's a chance. There's just a little chance that I might be that 7th person, and there is a certainty, an absolute certainty, that if myself and all of us don't say anything to her, that there will never be a seventh person.
Absolutely. And you never know if you're number two or three or what have you. So,
the answer is just play your part, ladies and gentlemen.
Just do it. Do it, yeah. And, you know, interesting, that brings up another way of using high leverage is activism, where if you're, instead of going out and protest, maybe you should just get seven people together and come in at different times and tell some storefront owner about X, Y, or Z, you know. Either going to take your property or, you know, going to raise your tax. If you did that, you could actually play that seven-person thing on them by having seven what's seemingly randomly people, you know, tell them the same thing. I'll have to think about that for future activism.
Yeah.
That would go with my bankster outfit thing, you know. Yeah. If every one of the events, there's a couple new banksters coming and telling them, hey, you know, I'm going to – it's no problem, man. I'm going to end up buying – after we bulldoze your property, we're going to buy it up, man. 10 cents on the dollar. Yes, if enough bankster-looking people tell somebody that, they might actually believe it.
You know, it'd be great to actually go to, like, city council meetings or congressional hearings or public meetings and things like that where the officials are actually sitting there laying out economic policy, you know, trying to woo the crowd and what have you. And then you just stand up and you ask questions and pretend to be one of these banks to scum and you just say, excuse me, sir, I love your legislation because it'll allow me to invest in this country and take most of its strategic assets for pennies on the dollar. I believe that you, sir, are going to be a great leader for New Zealand. You know, that kind of thing. Just encourage them to steal and destroy the country and act like it's a good thing. But use real words. You know, don't use these smarmy BS, oh, we're going to create jobs kind of stuff. Just really get in there and go for the jugular.
Absolutely. I think people should do this. They should amp it up a little bit, amp up the game, you know. I mean, it's interesting how much people one of the problems, obviously, we've been inundated our entire life with a bunch of pseudoscience and pseudo everything. And, you know, so many people are obviously acting within that system that it's hard for other people to stretch a little, you know, stretch away from that model because, hey, everyone's doing it. And, you know, if I jump outside that, I look like a freak, whatever. But, you know, even in finance, so you mentioned the banksters and all that. I mean, I was thinking about taking an MBA at some point, and I just couldn't wrap my mind around learning something from, you know, force-fed, foie gras type pseudoscience from people who are teaching me, you know, about something that's like 50, 100-year-old thinking. But I met this guy who was just all amped up with arrogance about how, you know, how smart he was, and he was going to be, you know, working on these derivatives and all this kind of crap after got out. And I said, you know, that's interesting. Do you know Black-Scholes formula, which is what's used for options pricing, and pretty much every financial transaction on earth can be mapped into Black-Scholes, unfortunately. But he's like, yeah, I studied Black-Scholes. And I said, you know, so Black-Scholes is a formula. Let's just say that every Greek is effectively a coefficient for some kind of part of the formula. And I said, what's the Greek for liquidity? And he looked at me, he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, you have these coefficients for everything, right? Well, what's the one for liquidity in a market? And he said, he just thought about it a minute. It's like short-circuited almost. And he's like, I don't know. I don't think there is one. It's like, yeah, exactly. It doesn't model reality. And so, you know, you're already studying garbage, right? And so the whole bankster system needs to create fake volume, fake liquidity, or whatever you want to call it, making markets, right, in order to even make a mathematical function approximate what actually happens in reality. And this guy didn't even know that. And he's talking about, you know, using this formula to create derivatives and whatnot. And so this is where we are, in the sense that even people who are ostensibly, you know, cream of the crop, whatever that means, going to, you know, really big name schools, which I don't want to mention, but they sound like Wharton, and they, you know, and they think that they really got the, you know, the bull by the horns, and they really are just fed garbage pseudoscience. You know, it's kind of a bummer to see, and that's why it just gives me that much more motivation to think that the next system really is. There's no saving. The existing one just doesn't even work for us anymore. We need to forget about the people. But however, I do. What you said dials me back into realizing that we shouldn't forget it altogether, because we can use the language and the words of the old system in a way to actually activate people.
Mm. Well, who was it that accused me of something? A rap artist named Luca. He should have called himself Loser because it was more appropriate name for this piece of trash. But he was like telling me that, accusing me of being some kind of a paid shill. It's like, it's not an accident that Vinny's gotten so popular, you know. It's like, of course it's not an accident. Look at how awesome I am, Loser. You know, look at how hard I work. But the element here that I found very interesting is that even people within the truth movement fight with other people within the truth movement. You know, you cannot avoid it. There's always infighting. There's always arguing. There's always these people who say that they're awake that are simply and patently, obviously incapable of thought.
You know, I actually discovered this phenomena in the 80s being an open source author. So apparently it sort of maps into a lot of different systems. And in fact, in the open source community, you'll find that for any one piece of software, there's probably, you know, 3 or 4 or 20 different applications that do fairly similar things, none of which were finished to 100%, of course. And that's one of the problems with that. But then within the community, they're all firing bullets at each other. And I came to the conclusion that it's probably not a good idea to fire at people in neighboring foxholes. You know, when there's a war on, I'm thinking the guy next to you might be a better friend than an enemy. And I think that, you know, we really need to get that message out to activists as well as open source people that, you know, not everyone has to think exactly alike. In fact, it's probably a good thing that we don't. But, you know, you might want to look at the big picture, you know, before go fighting with each other. And I think, I mean, how fun must that be for the establishment, though? You know, they're out there, you know, jazzing people with all kinds of, you know, shills and whatnot, trolls. And I almost wondered, do they even need to, right? You know, in some ways, people kind of troll each other. So, by the way, I've got a whole bunch of other kind of topics that are sort of interesting to me that I think really aren't being talked about.
We still have many, but I wanted to quickly add an interjection before we go into that, because you know what you said just reminded me of? There's an episode of Family Guy where, the Griffins get accused by their neighbors of being, of Stewie Griffin being a crack baby, right? So social services takes them, puts them in another home, and it's a home where they have like 5 other unwanted children, and they're all of different races and cultures and what have you, okay? And they like want Stewie to join them, and they go, Stewie, come complete our rainbow. You know, they're all lying in a rainbow shape on the thing. And he goes, I have a better idea. Why don't we play swallow the stuff under the sink? And and towards the end of it, Stewie realizes that he can actually become the most powerful child in the house by getting all of these kids who are of different races and cultures to fight with each other. And at the very end, he's being carried away by his dad to go home for real. And all these kids are fighting each other. And as he's being carried away, he shrieks out, dance, puppets, dance.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of how it is when you get to the wrong crew of people. And you know, that kind of does dial into a favorite topic of mine, and that is that you know, we have all these things like LinkedIn and, you know, obviously Twitter, Facebook, and all these millions of social networking tools. You know what the world really needs, and this is just absolutely a critical piece, I think, of tomorrow's cryptocurrency, is a credibility network. We need a way that we can have like a tapestry of people on it that can assess other people. And you only can assess so many people so that people don't just, you know, do the LinkedIn thing where you have like 500 people or 1,000 and you have no idea. You can't remember who these people are. But the way that you really know who somebody is, and you're Vinny Eastwood's willing to vouch for, you know, Guy X. And if Guy X turns out to be a real, you know, crap head, then by the way, you lose credibility too. Right. So if we had something like that, then when it comes to events, it comes to when you're blogging online, to finding out who's, if someone real or not, you know, if you want to assess, it's sort of like Yelp. Do you have Yelp in New Zealand for restaurants?
No.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's a restaurant crowdsourced restaurant rating service. And it actually, despite all the fraud that goes on, it actually kind of has error correction built in, and it works. It works pretty well. If we had that kind of service for people, then you could actually bolt that on to all these chat rooms and blogs, and you could build an app so you could find out who's at some kind of a mixer or some kind of an activist event. And you could really screen out not only stooges, but you could just screen out people that aren't really stooges, but they're just kind of douchebags.
Well, you know, you can never fully keep infiltrators out, and that's what the quote-unquote Illuminati are famous for, is infiltrating, you know? I mean, that's why they call them traitors. Because they infiltrate you. Well,
I think the key is, I mean, obviously, there's no perfect solution. I think the key is to have a system where...
By the way,
go ahead.
I have a cunning solution for how to not lose credibility.
Okay.
Never claim to have any.
That's a good place to start, right?
Then you can't lose it, can you?
The thing is, by claiming that, you would probably gain credibility, though.
Exactly. Which is why it is an incredibly cunning solution.
I think that explains your show.
Yeah. You can not only never lose credibility, but you can never not gain it either.
Have you kept track of any of these alternative, I call them socioeconomic models, like Venus Project and Zeitgeist? And
I was involved in its inception when Zeitgeist 3 screened in Auckland. No, sorry, Zeitgeist 2. I was the only person allowed into the theater without purchasing a ticket, because I'm Vinnie frickin' Eastwood.
That's something, man. Yeah.
Even the organizers had to pay.
There's got to be perks, man. That's kind of interesting. What do you think about Zeitgeist?
Anything that says we need a system for everybody, rather than saying, actually, bro, you personally need to take responsibility for your own life and go out and solve problems yourself the way you see fit in walking with spiritual awareness and doing God's work. Basically, anything that says anything other than that, not terribly interested in, to be honest.
That's a good way to look at it. I kind of feel the same a lot. I mean, Venus Project and Zeitgeist to me have a lot of good ideas, and because I have the philosophy of not, you know, shooting people in the next foxhole, I never say anything bad. I feel like a little bit they have a direction that's pointed toward a sort of a scientific dictatorship, but at the end of the day, just like you said, inspiring people for responsibility and new ideas is a good thing. In fact, actually, someone recently said, you know, I have all these ideas and I'm presenting to people, and they said, well, that sounds like socialism. And to be honest with you, it probably sounds more like anarchism. But unfortunately, people can't pattern match properly. And so I said, no, it's not anything to do with socialism. It's probably the opposite. Like, what do you mean? Like, well, you think about it. Anarchism is freedom derived from personal responsibility, and socialism is just give up your freedom and personal responsibility and hope someone maintains, you know, to a few elite people and hope they deal with it responsibly. And that's not going to happen.
Hope that somebody else can run my life better than I can.
Yeah. Like, how the heck is that the same? I don't get that. But anyway.
Why do people go out and protest in favor of socialism? What the hell?
If I give up everything, you'll protect me. That's going to happen.
I mean, how's that working out for you, for your protester who's getting pepper sprayed for absolutely no reason? You know, how's authoritarianism working out for you? And you're protesting in favor of it in the meantime while you're dealing with the consequences of supporting it in the first place.
I'm sorry I got in your eyes, but we have to protect the public.
Yeah. You know, it's for your protection. Oh, my God. I feel so protected now.
Thanks for the handcuffs, too.
You know, my wrists were feeling all soft and supple and stuff. And this is much better. This is much better. This is perfect.
we prevented a thought felony. You know, today, actually, was in South Election, South Africa, they had the elections. And the Ubuntu Party was running in that election. So it's kind of interesting. They're another one of these alternative models, if you know Michael Pellinger, maybe.
Yeah, I've had Michael on the show a number of times, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic guy. He's just a really articulate guy, you know. And again, it's a set of ideas, and you don't have to buy into all of them. It's just great that people are thinking about responsibility and actually contributing instead of extracting. He seems to be friends with another model, which is the New Earth Project or New Earth Nation, as they seem to be transitioning to, with Sasha Stone. Have you talked to him?
No, I don't think so.
Probably be a great, if he'll get on the show, it'd be a great guest.
Do you know him? Can you hook me up, brother?
I don't know him. I'll ask Michael to get a hold of him, because I got to say, I mean, I digest a lot of content. I think that Sasha Stone is probably one of the most articulate humans I've ever heard in my life. That guy is just brilliant, man.
Man after my own heart.
Yeah, and you know what? It's interesting because he's so articulate, and he's so, you know, connected on all kinds of levels, whether it's spiritual or just reality, whatever. Someone tried to pin him with that, you know, you sound like a guru. And I really loved his response. He said, "Bah, I'm a guru slayer. We don't like gurus around here. We think for ourselves." That's, you know, that's a man of my own kind. But, you know, those are sort of some of the projects that I've seen. And I'd say that I think the North Project and the Ubuntu guys are probably a little closer to aligned to what I have in mind, in the sense that, you know, they don't propose, like with the Venus Project, they seem to want to, you know, put sensors everywhere on the Earth and pipe all that information into the centralized computer grid, you know, run by smart people. And don't worry, they're smarter than us. So they'll run all the sensors and allocate resources and stuff like that. And until, you know, in my mind, I think centralization and its ugly cousin intermediation are some of the worst possible, you know, sort of attack vectors for corruption.
By the way, Kevin, can you name me a single society throughout the entirety of history that used centralization as its, you know, structural organism, whatever, that didn't wind up either starving to death or being exterminated in war?
Short list. Can't think of any.
Yeah, that's because they don't freaking exist. This is what centralization does. This is what hierarchy, power, and control, and this is the reason why psychopaths crave it so and always reintroduce it and repackage it every single century, even every decade now. In fact, they're running out of game plan here. They're running out of new tricks. They've been using the same old tricks for thousands of years, and we're suddenly starting to realize that the tricks in the first freaking place, and they still keep using them, and people still keep freaking falling for them. It's unbelievable.
Well, here's a dilemma they have. After you've centralized everything and you run out, what do you do?
I don't know. Who was it? I think it was Ronald Reagan who said the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of everybody else's money.
Exactly. You know, you had this great guest, Kevin Annett, or Onnit, how do you say
it? Yeah, Annett, yeah.
Annett, and he said something really interesting. He was researching and he was reading some old, religious papers or whatever, and they were saying how, I think it was from the Jesuits, they were saying how they realized you have to brutalize children from 0 to 7 years old in order to beat it out of them, because children just inherently do not accept hierarchy or being working slaves. That's a reality that's just not inherent in a human being. You have to brutalize them, and then on the other side, you give them goodies to kind of attract them. It's the carrot and stick thing.
Yeah, well, incidentally, it's the same way you break a horse.
Yeah.
Kevin, we're coming to break now. Let's hold that thought. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. This episode is sponsored by Kevin, thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. Back in a tick. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Can I walk here beside you? Can I speak your name? Can I just be here? Can I speak in anger? Can I speak in shame? Can I just be here?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, is the final segment now with Kevin Lawton from thecrowdfundingrevolution.com. You can get the book off of my website, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. And bear in mind, if you do want to support this broadcast, advertisers contribute just a little amount, but the bulk of the funding comes from your donations and subscriptions. This is listener-funded in the main, and even the people who advertise on this, some of them don't pay very much or give me much for their ads, but because they're good people with independent businesses that aren't involved with the scumbaggery New World Order system that wants to wipe out and exterminate us all, I'll give it to them anyway, you know, just because. My very special guest, Kevin Lawton, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back once again.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, you had quite a long list of talking points. I wondered which of the ones are you most interested to cover in the final segment here, you know, something juicy, something big, something nasty.
Yeah, well, let's start with capitalism and then let's wind our way to Burning Man. I think that would be an interesting little pathway.
Yeah, you know, that'd be good because I've actually envisioned burning some capitalists at the stake before myself.
Well, I went out to Burning Man this last round, and it was quite a trip. You know, we only burned a big, giant wooden figure and a giant flying saucer-shaped structure, but, you know, there could have been bankers on it. You know, the interesting thing or actually, why waste the big structure on only one? So we were talking a little bit before the break about, you know, how you essentially have to brutalize people to even make children think that, hey, this hierarchy is actually even a good thing. And really, I got to say, you know, as much as I've been involved in capitalism and startups and the whole bit, you know, it occurs to me, essentially, capitalism is a form of brutalization. It just keeps going past the 7-year mark all the way through most people's lives. You know, like someone was talking recently, like I want to start my own business, you know, and just, I was kind of joking. I said, you know, just think about the term busyness. That's the idea of capitalism, right? Get you running around so busy, not paying attention that, you know, oh, well, you got to pay your taxes. Okay, well, I'll get that done. Well, I got to get back to my work, you know, that you don't even have time to actually think about what you're doing, you know, and so you end up kind of getting wrapped up into that. And at the end of the day, what is capitalism? Well, it's, you know, all about accumulating more and more capital, right? So then you ask people, okay, well, what's capital? What's money? And it's one of my favorite questions. Is kind of, it's a little bit of an economic geek kind of a thing, but I love to ask people, what is money, right? What do you think it is? And they come up with all this textbook crap about fungibility and, you know, unit accounting and all this stuff. It's nothing to do with that. I mean, if you look at the founder of some of the schools, like the Austrian school of economics, people talk about von Mises, but really his mentor, I think the pronunciation's Menger, he actually stated what capitalism and what our view of value exchange is, and that is that value only lives in the minds of people. There is no such thing as a store of value or anything like that. It's just in our minds. And if that's true, then the store of value is just a store in each other, right? But the system's got us running around, you know, chasing these things that they print, which aren't really even money. They don't certainly store any wealth. They don't represent anything other than a unit of debt, unfortunately, a usury-based debt. And so they keep people busy. And I think, like, to extend Kevin Annett's statement about brutalizing kids to the 7 that live in hierarchy, I think we have to brutalize people until they're about 30 or 40 to make them think that running around being busy all the time, in quotes, working for a living, is a natural thing for a human to even do. And that kind of leads to, you know, I always refer back to my favorite, you know, Buckminster Fuller, but he had this great quote about, you know, we got to get rid of the specious notion that everyone has to earn a living. And at the end of it, you know, he was talking about how one person in 10,000 could come up with such a technological idea that the rest of them don't even need to work. And so he ended with this, which I'd like to read quickly, which is, you know, so we keep inventing jobs because of this false idea that everybody has to be employed at some kind of drudgery because, according to Malthusian Darwinian theory, he must justify his right to exist. So we have inspectors of inspectors and people making instruments for inspectors to inspect inspectors. The true business of people should be go back to school and think about whatever it is they were thinking about before someone came along and told them they had to earn a living.
Kevin, it's funny you should say justify your existence, because that's what I do and try to do every day is justify my existence. The problem is, the difference is, that I'm justifying my own existence. Nobody else is telling me to justify it.
I think that's a good way to look at it, because really what is, you know, the kind of narcissistic psychopath, right? They're in some ways.
By the way, I'm also a narcissist.
Yeah, a little bit of that's not a bad thing.
Well, not benign narcissism, like what's his name, Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali. They were totally full of themselves. You know, I'm the best. I'm the best, and whatever they were. you know, it's like that's narcissism. It's pretty much an inability to deny your own awesomeness. Thank you.
No, what a psycho trip that would be, being around, you know, in the ring with somebody, and they're like, "I'm the greatest." You know.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the problem with narcissists versus psychopaths is that I see psychopaths as my natural enemy because they have all the same characteristics that I do, except they don't have empathy.
Sure.
Right. That's the one thing that I've got in spades that these vipers, these evil scum don't have, and that makes them my enemy and the enemy of all people.
Yeah, well, that in a way that makes them, you know, prime violators of natural law, which is really just a mutual respect, you know, and you see it in every religion and every kind of spiritual thinking. There's some kind of a yin yang or golden rule or whatever, some kind of a thing that really boils down to natural law, which is essentially we have freedom by personal responsibility and, you know, kind of a mutual respect thing. And really, empathy is the missing piece that allows people, unfortunately, to pop out of that model and not live within natural law.
Well, that's why they outlawed E. I think it was back in, was it the 60s or 50s, I think, when they first invented E. I forget. But it didn't stand for ecstasy. It stood for empathy. And it was prescribed for family violence. They give a violent father an E, send him home to his kids. He'd never lay a hand on him again. He just loves him so much. Oh, my God, they're so soft. Oh, my, I love you so much. You can't hurt him. And so they're like, oh, my God, this is helping people to be empathetic and not scumbags. Illegal!
Well, if you invested in Corrections Corp of America, you'd probably be happy they outlawed it, you know. And you know, I joke about those kind of things, but I got to say, back during the first invasion or whatever you want to call it in Iraq, I had a friend, you know, and he kind of saw the war drums beating. And so he goes out and finds some small stock where the company manufactured body bags, you know, and he invested in it and made a nice little pop from the war because he knew it was coming on, you know. And I'm just thinking, wow, that's a whole different mindset right there. I actually have a friend in prison these days for allegedly selling ecstasy and maybe a few other things. He was, you know, the really unfortunate thing besides destroying, you know, a really nice person's life is he was kind of a community leader around a tea house. And he was just probably the most magical guy I've ever met in my life. But I guess, you know, allegedly had a few things on the side. And, you know, here's this guy who really means absolutely nothing. His intent is nothing other than just spreading goodness and enlightening people and making them more healthy. That was really his mission in life. And this guy is like in prison. And, you know, when you see that firsthand, it really, you know, it really hits you, the kind of system that we have and that we're doing everything we can to take the most high conscious people in the world and throw them in some kind of jail, you know, make money off them apparently. It's pretty dismal, but you know, it's kind of where we are now. And that's, you know, just hopefully that just fires people up more to, you know, kind of pop out of this system and build something new, because the old ones just broke, you know?
Yeah, I think whistleblowers are like probably one of the key figures to that. Like in the modern age, the ability to actually really change things and help people to see things with the way they really are, whistleblowers seem to be the people to look at. It kind of makes me want to cry because these people have their money, homes, family, friends and careers disappear for defending humanity from scumbaggery. And I'm sitting here getting donations and recognition for doing the same kind of thing, but making way less sacrifice. And I think that's the reality for which I and all of us really should be ashamed. But I don't really feel guilty about it because I interview whistleblowers and I help their voices be heard, merely as an effort to make up for my own failings and lack of self-sacrifice for the greater good. And in so doing, I believe this justifies my existence.
Well, you know, on the other hand, it's hard to be an activist from inside a jail sometimes, too. So, you know, maybe it's good that you're, you know, doing what you're doing. Anyway, as I understand it, you're kind of the alternate media guy in New Zealand, right?
Yeah. No
one else has stepped
there's
up.
There's two types of alternative media. Yeah. There's those who are mainstream alternative media, who only really comment on mainstream media articles. And then there's new media, which actually talk about the stuff exclusively that the mainstream media never talks about or sidelines or demonizes or issues, which means, unfortunately, you really have to cover everything that they cover as well. But I don't know. It's quite strange, Kevin, in the last... Shoot, how long have I been in this house? I think 5 months, 5 months. My radio in my car has been dead. I haven't listened to any mainstream talk radio. My TV aerial has been dead. I haven't watched any mainstream news. And you know what's funny, Kevin? I don't feel any less informed.
You're probably more informed because you haven't been inundated with such garbage.
Well, it's what Mark Twain said. He said, oh, no. Was it Mark Twain or Thomas Jefferson? I think it was Jefferson, actually. He said, those who only read newspapers are less informed than those who read nothing at all. And the Twain quote was, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed.
That's interesting, yeah. I mean, I'm the same as you. I don't do TV, and my only newspapers is I read the headlines when they're sitting in the newspaper box, only for a sort of an entertainment, a dark entertainment. So I read the headlines, and I pretty much know right away what the actual story was just by the headline. But that, you know, I've been kind of reading and figuring out what's going on in the world for most of my life. So you sort of get that skill after a while. But I sort of don't read it the same way people do. And then at that, it's just the headline, because the rest is garbage anyway, right? The headline's telling you what they're trying to make you think right off the bat. So it's just one of those things that I've had people I know who got out of reading newspapers because they just at some point realized, you know, I'm not getting anything out of this, and I'm just going to pop out of this. So you just cut your subscription to the newspaper and, you know, try to find some other sources. The only thing about that is for a lot of people, it's once you start, there's this sort of ceiling, right, where people hit, where you start learning stuff and then you realize, wow, there's a lot more to learn. So then you go learn that. And then it seems like, you know, for every stone you turn over, there's another 10. And it tires out a lot of people, or they just don't have the wherewithal or bandwidth to do it. So then they kind of tire out and they burn out and they go back. Sometimes they slip back into the old, you know, old reality that they were stuck in before. It's an interesting dynamic to see. So I guess one of the things, though, that I found where it's really effective for waking people up is, this is unfortunate, but when their health goes bad.
Yeah, or when they get busted by the cops for no good reason. You know what's funny? Here's the irony, Kevin. The worse stuff that happens to you, the more likely you are to wake up and realize there's something wrong. In fact, somebody called in my show, I think it might have been... last year, or maybe 2012. I can't remember when this happened, but they asked me, Vinny, how am I supposed to wake people up? I just don't know how to do it. And I go, well, you could call the police and report them for a crime they didn't commit. And when the cops come, bust into their house, tear up their couches, rip their TV to pieces, shred their stereo system, and then when they don't find anything, still bind them in handcuffs and then take them down to the cells with all the really nasty criminals and take their shoelaces off and their belts and everything like that, and then leave you in there while they make jokes about you just outside your cell and what have you while you're crying and on the floor and enjoying your suffering, etc. They'll wake up pretty freaking quickly. Or they will be damaged for life, irreparably. Okay, yeah. That's the kind of thing. It's like Ebola. You know, you leave a person with Ebola in the hut for 3 days. They either come out alive or they don't come out at all. Right?
Now that, my friend, is a thought grenade.
It's funny you should mention that, because I've been calling them information grenades. You, if you're arguing with somebody who's like, basically, you can't argue with them because they're too freaking stupid to listen or look at evidence. What you do is you do the information grenade. You pull the pin, you say something, and then you walk out of the room and you wait for it to blow up in their face later.
Absolutely, yeah. Get them thinking. My favorite thing is to tell somebody something that sounds like what they want to hear. That, oh, you got to, yeah, I know something about that. Go look this up, and then give them a pointer to something and then have them find out that, oh, this isn't actually what I thought it was. This is worse. Right. So instead of having to tell them, then they end up finding out on their own. So,
unfortunately, that's a constant realization for a lot of truthers. Man, it's a lot worse than I thought it was.
it's an everyday occurrence, you know.
Yeah. It's daily, you know. Like, because your understanding of how fracked up everything is gets expanded on a daily basis. Awareness does not set you free, ladies and gentlemen, nor does knowledge. If anything, it burdens and weighs you down for the rest of your freaking existence. Enjoy.
Favorite bumper sticker actually was the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off.
Yeah, that's true. speaking of bumper stickers, I saw a really good one. Do you know about Holdens and Fords and how there's a big kind of rivalry between these two car manufacturers and fans of them and that kind of thing?
Not aware of that.
No. Okay, well, anyway, in New Zealand, all the police cars are Holdens, right? And I saw a Ford driving along and it had a bumper sticker saying, "Only pigs drive Holdens."
Actually, that could be kind of a marketing thing, too. You know, I mentioned Burning Man earlier. We could talk a little bit about Burning Man, because that was... I hope people have had a chance to go to that, and if they don't, that they do in the future, because it's, you really can't understand what a new system is like until you just live in it, you know, until you really get there and you spend enough time seeing other people live in a different system. And there are, you know, I think Burning Man's changing, or there's other, well, the worldwide events are sort of like it, I understand, but that it really changes people's perspective, because, you know, you go there and there's this huge line to get in. It takes hours to get in, and it's like capitalism outside the fence and anarchy inside. You know, you got to go through this long line so you can get checked to make sure you paid your few $100 ticket, you know. And then after the capitalism ends, you get in, and it's just this new world of you know, people's, there's no commerce at all. You're not able to sell anything. So that leaves people with essentially giving out stuff. So you're supposed to find something you like to give out and, you know, and exchange with people. So what happens is, instead of, you know, people trying to set up businesses, they actually find something they're passionate about. And they do that. You know, people set up bars and they set up tents with yoga and tents for meditation, and there's even like a TEDx event at Burning Man where people talk about some pretty interesting stuff. But then, you know, there's this nightlife of just complete anarchy. It's like a combination. It's hard to describe. It's like a combination of being in a, you know, sort
a
of
dance club and a hippie commune.
Yeah, combined with Mad Max.
Oh yeah,
that's movie.
That's totally, you know, right.
It's you know, it's out there. It's on a desert playa, so there's, and the wind picks up. So you have these sandstorms, and imagine this: there's these these roads that are sort of rings, and then there's spikes, these spoken wheels that kind of connect as well. That their roads are just made out of the just, you know, cordoned off areas, whatever. And there's no directionality on the road. So other than the art cars, which drive around and blast out techno music and have hot chicks on them and stuff, there's really no directionality on the road. So there's bikes and there's people walking and art cars. The sandstorms are coming up. It's dark, and you know, you see just the glow of people's lights and all kinds of stuff. Techno's blasting out. And you're thinking, at some point it hit me, geez, there's no directions. There's no like left side and right side or whatever. And people are kind of just careening around each other and, you know, near Missile Central all the time. But yet, generally, there's no, you don't really hit anybody. And it just hits you at some point that, you know, maybe we don't actually need people telling us where the stop sign is and the light and the, you know, the dashed lines and, you know, where you can pass and what the speed limit is and all this stuff. It's just, it's a place where you can go where you just pop outside rules, and it's left for people to have this thing called personal responsibility. And I got to tell you, man, it, you know, there's always a couple douches slipping here and there, but it's actually a really amazing place. And the people were, you know, maybe because they're in a different space, but when people don't have rules, they oddly enough revert to this thing where you actually absorb some responsibility.
If there's no rules and they see problems and other people needing help, they're far more likely to go and help them because they know that there's no actual authority that's going to help them. So if they see it, they do something. It's kind of like it's like a weird interpretation of the "see something, say something" campaign run by the Department of Homeland Security
at Walmart. Yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think you know, in the regular world, wherever, it's not really regular, but this world we live in, people sort of become immunized, and you know, will drive by someone in need, right? And you know, somebody else with a cell phone will call for help or something. But there, you're absolutely right. It's a different mindset. In fact, it's such a different way of living that when people come back, there are some people who are more sensitive because it just resonates so strongly with them that they become depressed when they get back, and they have to go through Burning Man decompression events to sort of ease their way back into this capitalist society we live in. And it's kind of interesting. It's a little easier for me for whatever reason. I guess I'm just sort of an observationalist, but they literally, people, it affects them deeply because they realize the rest of their life sucks. And, you know, and then they go there and they feel at home. You know, it's kind of funny. It's at night and I'm riding my bike around and I'm trying to, like, you know, careen around people and not hit people or get deafened by all the techno music playing and stuff. And I get kind of so, you know, into the, it's like you fall back into your pattern of, like, you know, kind of stressing and trying to get somewhere fast. And this guy comes biking by and he's so happy and he goes, "Wow, man, have a good Burning Man," you know? And I realized, you know, I'm bringing my tension there. You know, I'm riding around and for that moment, maybe I'm kind of the douche, you know? You know, people are trying to have a good vibe and here I am bringing my kind of city-esque vibe in there, you know, and you sort of, you lose that quickly, but it takes a little bit for the walls to kind of drop down. And
when in Rome.
Absolutely, man. It's so I can see when you've got these, whether it's the Zeitgeist or the Ubuntu or the New Earth Nation people, you know, they really have their finger on something and creating something completely new where it's a balance of responsibility and, you know, contribution. Is it, because it happens. I mean, people go out there and, you know, you talked about, I think maybe it was before the call started officially, but you know, crowdfunding and, you know, so to some extent people can have a feeling like being a mooch. I mean, you could literally be a professional mooch out there. You could go with nothing and there's so many people giving out stuff. You could mooch out there. But even that, with that dynamic, it almost doesn't matter because there are so many people giving their passion out. They just, people want a chance to actually give something out. It's really strange. I mean, you get, you know, you think people are trying to save all their money in capitalism and, you know, pinch pennies and whatever, and then they'll go and just blow a fortune making these amazing camps and buildings and everything. that people just fundamentally want to give if we were allowed a system where that could flourish.
Or if they have any money left over after the government taxes the remaining spare cash. Now, Kevin Lawton has been my very special guest. This has been a very, very quick interview. His website is thecrowdfundingrevolution.com, and there is the Crowdfunding Revolution book banner on the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. And also, just another reminder yet again, this is a predominantly listener-supported broadcast, so please go to the homepage and subscribe today. Little regular donations are actually really good because it means I don't have to constantly beg for donations, especially towards the ends of particular periods where a whole lots of bills all come in at once. Have you ever noticed that, ladies and gentlemen, that whenever you think you've got spare money and you check your letterbox, it's a bad move, isn't it? Okay, Kevin, thank you very much for your time.
It's been an honor, man. Love being on your show.
And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. I'll see you again next time.